Hi, everyone. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is the A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the stories and books and movies that they love and the traces of the one reality that lie beneath.
That's right. Yep, for sure. That's what we do. And I forgot to look it up. I was just typing that in there. What number are we on? 24?
24?
I think it's 24. Yeah. And we're going to talk about Tokyo Godfathers, an anime film from 2003.
Yeah, that's based all around, it's set between Christmas Eve and New Year's.
Yes.
Which I don't think I actually realized, thought about the New Year's part until I was looking up information on the movie.
Oh, wow. But so how did you first see this movie?
This movie, it seems like it must have been 2003 or 2004, but it must have been 2003 now that I think about it. But there was a time period where Hannah, our oldest daughter, went through a severe depression. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, I spent a lot of the summer trying to do a lot of diverting things that, you know, you sound like the ideal parent. You never actually do most of them. Mm-hmm. And one of them was we went to see all these different movies that came out at the two art theaters that are close to us. And that summer, a lot of anime was going through. We saw Steam Boy, and we also saw a lot of documentaries like The Weeping Camel and Paperclip and that kind of thing that were appropriate for younger people to see. And then Tokyo Godfathers was there. And I was so stunned watching that because there were such clear messages for Christians in it that I didn't realize a Japanese movie could have those, and certainly not an anime. And then when I was looking up other reviews for this, that's what everybody was saying. The Christians who were commenting would go, oh, I found it so inspirational. And even the people who weren't said, well, you know, they're handled lightly enough, since the Japanese are only 1% Christian, that anybody can enjoy it. But you can't deny the message that they're trying to give you about coincidence and God and miracles and family. And I was like, okay, even the people who are not Christian are having to give this its due, so I'm not making it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's kind of how I felt about it, too. Initially, you know, for about the first 10 minutes or so, I was like, what? what are we watching here? So then, but, you know, as I allowed myself to get into it, it turned out to be a pretty enjoyable experience. I haven't watched a lot of anime in the past. Oh. In fact, I looked it up last night, and it turns out all the anime I've seen is by the same guy, Hayao Miyazaki. Yeah. So Spirited Away and Howl's Moving Castle.
My Neighbor Totoro.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've seen maybe three or four films is all.
This stuff is so great.
Yeah.
But, and so I've also seen Cowboy Bebop. Have you ever seen that?
No, I haven't.
Highly enjoyable and very accessible to Western minds. In fact, when we were watching it, we said, oh, I bet Joss Whedon liked this because it's really got a feel reminiscent of Firefly.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. It's about several bounty hunters that travel around, you know, doing whatever needs to be done. And they're not nearly as moral as Mal, although they're generally moral. But it's kind of a little mind-bending, but very much like Firefly. And it's a series, you know, it was a TV series. So it's like, I think, half-hour segments.
Oh, okay.
And they're really defined by the really fantastic jazz and music that is used in the series. And the one, there was a movie that was made and distributed in America, which is where I first saw it, and I really liked it. And then I went to Half Price Books and found a set of DVDs that was called the Remastered Episodes. And those were ones where between the guy who originated it and the fans, they had chosen the ones where they thought the music was most important. And so he'd gone in and remastered them all. and released them. And so it's kind of a sampling of the show.
Oh, interesting.
And ever since then, I've really wanted to get all of them because I just really loved them. Kind of, like I say, like Firefly.
Yeah, yeah. And so I
highly recommend it.
Yeah, there was previews in the front of the DVD, which I got from Netflix.
Oh, okay.
There were previews there. And Steam Boy, which you mentioned earlier as, you know, your review was one word, meh.
Don't watch it.
Okay, not meh. It was lower than meh. It was
Yes.
Yeah, so that's the first time I'd ever heard of that title. And then Cowboy Bebop was there too. So I noticed this movie was rated PG-13. There's, you know, a little bit of language in there. And then the Cowboy Bebop was rated R on the previews. Is that the same one we're talking about?
I haven't seen enough of them. But, well, the costumes are much more outrageous, you know, because it's obviously science fiction. One of the female bounty hunter, what she's wearing is usually just barely covering anything it needs to. And I don't know what else is. There's drug use.
Okay.
I was just curious as
to, you know, what would be rated R.
A lot of violence.
It.
Yeah, you know, it's for grown-ups. And I think that's the thing, that if you haven't come across anime before, the Japanese don't, and maybe everybody knows this, but I'll just say it, the Japanese don't really distinguish animation as a child's medium the way it's tended to be looked at here. So they just look at it as it's another art form. So you'll find all kinds of movies or, this is more common here, manga, which is their comic book art, is it can be pornographic. You know, now I don't think our comic books necessarily are, but you know, you'll have adult comics or graphic novels, as they're called now. So, but there it's much more common. In fact, after we saw Tokyo Godfather, we said, oh, Satoshi Kon, this was pretty good. That's the director's name. So we looked for something else by him called Millennium Actress, and whoa, it was. You think this might have been a little hard to get used to. That one was much more mind-bending on the use of a non-linear time scale. And it was very hard to tell. It was about somebody whose life spanned a great number of years, but you couldn't tell when she was in a movie acting it out or when it was her life acting it out. And you were just hanging on by the skin of your teeth. And according to Rose, who went on and watched another really famous one of his called Paprika, that was fairly mild. He was very experimental, and you'll have a lot of experimental stuff done in anime also, because you can.
Yeah. And that's so one of the things that I thought of as I was watching this, you know, so here I'm watching, you know, a film aimed at adults that's anime. And it made me think at one point during the movie, you know, why isn't this used, you know, why couldn't you do a movie? For example, something that springs to mind is like Ringworld by Larry Niven.
Yeah.
Why couldn't you do that as an animated feature? You know, I know that Pixar is doing A Princess of Mars, which is a book that we just recently recorded for the SFF Audio podcast. But it's not animated. It's a mixture of live action and animation, you know. But, you know, when I originally heard about it, I thought, oh, how cool is that? You know, hopefully it's not like a Disney-fied, like a Tarzan was Disney-fied, but if they made that movie as an animated feature, but, you know, faithful to the book, pretty much, how cool would that be?
I feel the American audience wouldn't accept it.
Yeah, I wonder.
As if for adults, that they just look at it and go, oh, a cartoon.
Yeah, I wonder if that's true, you know, because there's... rich field of science fiction novels that could be done that way.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And I think that would be pretty cool.
Yeah, well, and I think the one thing that was done in that style would be A Scanner Darkly, which I haven't seen. But
yeah, I saw that movie. And
that they animated the actors, actually, after they'd acted it out, I think.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, I don't know that... I didn't like the film too much. I did see it. It was okay, but I really didn't understand the point of... there was probably some kind of a point, I don't know, of the animation. But the animation, it was just like, you know, why is this animated? You know, that was how I felt about it. It wasn't, you know, like it needed to be animated. It was just this, some kind of an artistic statement or something.
Right. Well, and you think about a lot of the movies that are done... could be animation. If they put the energy into animation that they're putting into 3D, which I have no interest in.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
And most people don't. Then think of what they could do if they just kept forcing it at the audience the way these big directors are now forcing 3D at people.
Yeah, and that's something I just completely just don't understand.
No, me either.
I just don't get it. You know, I watched a clip of they're putting out little, as we make the movie, you know, The Hobbit, is they're putting out these little short films. And I put one on my blog, and this particular short film was all about how they're doing the 3D on it. And I was just like, oh, you know, it's, you know, I feel bad for all these people making all this effort, but given the choice, 2D is, I mean, it's, there's no, I wouldn't even think about it. You know, I would watch it in 2D because every 3D experience I've had has been bad. Well, it doesn't help at all. I don't understand what the appeal is.
I wear glasses. Okay, so I'm already put off by the idea I have to put on glasses over my glasses. And then I realize that's silly, but that's where it starts. And they just need to realize that I'm pretty open-minded compared to a lot of people. And I don't think the 3D sales have been showing a good return. I mean, James Cameron's movie was one thing, but
yeah.
I think what I saw, Tom was telling me, I guess, that it's just every time they've got a 2D choice, audiences flock to 2D.
Yeah, and well, so I mean, that's good news from my perspective, because I worry that we're getting to 3D only, and you know, how disappointing is that going to be?
I was really worried when they were selling 3D TVs, and I was like, no, don't make me, because like, I'll just have to stop watching TV, and I don't want to.
Yeah, I'm just trying to imagine who is saying, oh, I've got to have a 3D TV so I can wear these glasses while I watch TV and have this movie look fake and gray.
Well, and yeah, and as Tom pointed out, the part of the deal with TV is anybody in the household can sit down and watch. Well, then you're limited by how many glasses you have and if you've lost them. And, you know, he's like, and are you going to do that to your little kids? And so we were vehemently anti. So I was glad to see they were pulling them off the market or pulling back or something like that.
Yeah, it's just, I just can only imagine that people just don't care.
Yeah.
You know, the one that I point to is Kung Fu Panda 2 is where that was the biggest experience I've had on 3D. You know, one of the biggest disappointments, because Kung Fu Panda 1, when I watched that, you know, with my kids at the theater, I was amazed at the animation and how crisp and clear it was, and just every detail, you know, the panda's hairs. Oh, I mean, it was just incredible. It was absolutely astounding. Yeah. And then Kung Fu Panda 2 comes around, and I watched that in 3D, and it was gray. You know, there were times where I took off my glasses to see, you know, what I could see without them. And I just couldn't see any of the animation detail. So, you know, when that comes out on DVD, I don't know if it has yet, but I'll take a look at it. And I imagine the animation is really good. It's just that I couldn't see it.
Yeah.
You know?
Because it was, well, and yeah, then you're depending on all the theaters to have those projectors done right. And there's a different level of difficulty. And, you know, where are you putting this strain on the system?
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense.
So,
but animation itself, I'm a big fan. I mean, I love animation. Yeah. So,
well, and I'm thinking the way that we first at least got used to the idea of anime in general was the kids watching Sailor Moon on TV. And a lot of people don't realize that some of those series started off in Japan as, you know, children's anime.
I see.
Yeah. And so a lot of the things you'll see in those, if you're familiar with them, there's a stylized way of communicating that you don't see in Tokyo Godfathers, which is very realistically done. But like when characters cry and streams of tears come out of their eyes or certain expressions they get on their faces, those are like shorthand for this is what this character is feeling, or, you know, it's very,
I remember my son was very much into Pokemon.
There you go.
As a kid. Thing. So, yeah. So I recall exactly what you're saying, you know, when one of them would cry, there was like a river coming from their eyes, but, and then they would just, you know, freeze frame on him or her crying and then they'd move on. And, there is this slight disconnect that I get when I'm watching anime that I did have during this movie. And I don't know. It's just a slightly odd feeling that I get. And I'm sure that it's cultural, Moments where they hold on a shot for what I would call too long. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that kind of stuff. And that must be some kind of a cultural difference, because I experienced that with all anime that I've seen.
Oh,
it's just a little bit of an odd feeling. You're like, what was that? You know, and every now and then, you know, you get that. And I felt that during this movie too.
Oh, okay. I guess in this one, I may have noticed that the first time I saw it, but this was the third or fourth time I'd seen it, because mm-hmm. we own it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's mine. That's how much I like it.
All right.
yeah, it was given to me for Christmas one year.
Cool.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's with all anime. It's not just this film, but it's just something
I was just thinking, because this movie is drawn very realistically, mm-hmm. and it's very, actually, it's a funny combination, I think, of realism and making a very definite point about, well, as I said earlier, coincidences, miracles, mm-hmm. family. And I guess I should say what the movie's about.
Sure,
now that we've talked about anime. I don't know. basically, let's see. I had heard before, and I couldn't find anything. I think some of the information has changed since I did my initial tiny review a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
When I started the blog, this might have been one of the first movies I ever talked about. But basically, it is about three homeless people. Jin is a middle-aged alcoholic. Hana, who's a drag queen transvestite, well, former drag queen, I guess, but transvestite. And Miyuki, who's a runaway teenager. They are homeless. They live in a cardboard box together, and they discover an abandoned newborn while they're searching around in the trash for something to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And they decide that they are going to try and find the baby's real parents and ask why they gave the baby away. That's the really short version.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is that actually Miss Hana, who they all seem to accept as she, because I even call her she,
mm-hmm.
even though she's clearly a transvestite, they all call her Miss Hana and accept her as a she, and Hana says, "I'll never get to be a mother. Let me keep the baby for one night, and then mm-hmm. we'll take her to the police." And in the bag with the baby, they find some things that could help them identify who the baby is, a key to a locker.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And in the locker, they find some pictures, so they start on their quest across the city because it's of a very identifiable landmark. And when the movie opens, it's actually Christmas Eve, and Hana and Jin are at, I guess it's like a local church, Catholic, but Christian church, because it opens with a shot of a baby in the manger,
mm-hmm.
goes to the Holy Family, goes to the little kids singing, and then goes to the preacher, who is talking about Jesus came for those with no place of their own to show them how to be alive. And that's really the theme of the movie that gets followed. So as they're trying to help Kyoko, which is a traditional Japanese name for a baby girl that means pure child. I looked that up, and they mm-hmm. do say her name is Pure, who Miss Hana keeps calling God's messenger. They themselves have to come to terms with the fact that they're kind of like a little family already, but they've got other family ties that they've been ignoring and hiding from.
Mm-hmm.
And so this brings them to, by New Year's, which is makes sense because New Year's is really the Japanese holiday. They have found their true places again, I would say.
Yeah, I would say too. And in dealing with this baby, or, you know, they decide to try to find its mother.
Mm-hmm.
But dealing with the baby has brought them each what they needed.
Yeah, and when I first saw the movie, I can't remember if this was shown with dubbing
mm-hmm.
or not. It doesn't seem like an art theater, but you can't tell if they were trying to attract a different audience or something.
Mm-hmm.
I could swear the baby's name was Grace, but I never saw it. But I haven't watched it with the dubbing since. Mm-hmm. We just always watch it with the characters, with the captions.
Yeah, and it's interesting, the name Kyoko keeps coming up in the movie.
Yeah.
That's what they named the baby. But then it turns out that name, there's a reason besides what it means. There's a reason mm-hmm. why they all liked that name.
Yeah, which I guess we can talk about later. But mm-hmm. there's a big emphasis also on Christmas, which is, as I think I said before, entirely uncharacteristic of the Japanese. On the IMDb little trivia page, they pointed out that practically any time a number is used, it's 1225. The number on the locker, when they go to the locker and say, oh, now we have to pay some more money. They owe $12.25 or whatever it would be in money.
Mm-hmm.
And the street address for where they're going is 1225. And the meter on the taxi is 1225. And the time on the clock in the Spanish-speaking people's place is 1225. Mm. And you see it over and over and over and over. And this repetition of the message over and over is everywhere, because when Kyoko keeps getting called, the baby keeps getting called God's messenger by Miss Hana,
mm-hmm.
you see angel wings everywhere, and those are God's messengers.
Right.
The yeah. place that we find out that she worked is looks like the Eiffel Tower, but it's got angel wings on it. It's called Angel Tower.
Mm-hmm.
Miyuki's cat had angel wings on its back. It was named Angel.
Right.
I mean, there's angels everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's like this, I don't understand this, because as I say, I looked everywhere and you never found anything saying the guy was Christian, which I really wouldn't expect, honestly. As I said, they're 1% of Japanese people are Christian. But, and it was written by Satoshi Kon, and also by the head scriptwriter of Cowboy Bebop.
Oh, they
wrote it together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it was a joint venture. It's widely mentioned as being his most accessible movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were talking about it around the house, and we said, well, maybe he was just trying to get this message across about what is the real meaning of Christmas. And we're like, why would he care? Because I had to look up then what is Christmas like in Japan. In thinking over this, and it's just a fun holiday. It's just they give gifts, because of course the Japanese are gift giving people and they love gifts. And one thing I found from somebody who lived there said, and they also they also love sparkly things, which sounded so condescending. But they're like, so they love the lights and the everything, and it's kind of treated more of as a romantic holiday for couples, like Valentine's Day.
Huh.
Santa comes, but a lot of times he's just replacing a Buddhist, I hate to say character, but a Buddhist figure who gives gifts, who's a big kind of hooded guy, carries a bag.
Oh, wow.
And their traditions include things like eating Kentucky Fried Chicken. It's the biggest day of the year for KFC in Japan. Everyone orders buckets of chicken to eat at home with their family.
How about that? I had no idea.
I know. I was like, what? And they think maybe it came from way back when it was first being viewed as Western people doing it, you know, after World War II. Well, they'd have a turkey. Well, there's no turkey there.
Uh-huh.
And KFC is very American, and it's hugely popular anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They give each other Christmas cakes, but they're like not fruit cakes. They're like sponge cakes or chocolate cakes with white icing and Santa on them. But there's every place I looked, and I looked a lot of places, no one says anything about it being even really recognized as being religious.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't even connect it. Wow. And I guess when we talk more about what the movie's like, there are so many coincidences that happen right before or after Miss Hana is talking about Kyoko being God's messenger. God mm-hmm. finding a way for them. She's the really religious one, which is really hilarious, actually. Kind of more in a, not in a Buddhist way, although on New Year's Eve, you do see them lining up at the shrines. I love the huge line of people at the shrines praying to the Buddha or their ancestors or whoever, because Shinto is an ancestor and nature-based religion, mm-hmm. and that's their main religion.
Right, yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a funny movie.
Yeah,
I know
we're
not making it sound funny, but there's a lot of like slapsticky humor almost.
Uh-huh.
broad humor.
Yep.
And then there are a lot of subtle things where Miss Han is extremely dramatic. So she'll stop and say, a haiku. And then she'll just say this haiku about whatever just happened, like crossing the street or something. And you'll see it being written in the corner of the screen. And everyone stops and listens. And then they just go on with what they're doing. And by the second or third time, you're just laughing because she's such a drama queen.
Right, right.
Or like when she's talking about, once I thought about suicide. I thought about taking off my shoes and taking my coat off and doing this and doing this. And while she's saying it, Miyuki is listening to her and they're looking over the bridge behind them on the other side of the bridge. Somebody's actually doing those exact things. So you're looking at it and you're going, oh my gosh. And then you have to laugh because of the way it's being presented to you.
Yeah.
You know?
Right, right.
Of course, I've seen it so many times, we might notice more of those things, but.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's all kinds of things to notice. I'm sure that I missed a lot of it. Yeah, and I did watch it. You know, I don't know how you watch this movie now, but I watch it with the subtitles.
Yeah, we did. Okay,
all right. So that's my preferred way to watch these, but I don't know if that... Okay, yeah, I don't know how people
feel
about that. In our
house, we always like to hear the original voices, although Miyazaki says that any dubbing is okay because those animated characters never had voices. You had to always put them in.
Right.
Which I thought was kind of a very open way to look at it.
Yeah.
But I still like to hear what the Japanese would have been. Yeah, how they would have
I enjoy hearing the voices. You know, even I think there was one point in the movie where the girl, Miyuki, she actually said a sentence in English. And when you hear it, you know, the Japanese person saying that, you know, it's neat.
Well, and it's actually the one thing that was used for humor because she's encountered somebody who's a Spanish-speaking family.
Uh-huh.
And this lady's talking to her only in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And Miyuki doesn't know what the – or no, I guess it's the guy in the cab, right? She's terrified. And he's talking to her in Spanish. And she doesn't know it, but she knows it's not Japanese. And so she says whatever she says in English, like, I know speak English. And so even though it's a terrifying moment because of what's happening, she's being taken hostage, actually.
Yeah.
You have to laugh because she has no idea. And I don't know if this happened for you, but living in Texas and being exposed to Spanish all the time, it was a funny moment because we understood a lot of what the Spanish-speaking people were saying, whereas the people in Japan who were watching it originally wouldn't probably have understood any of it.
Right, yeah.
It would have been for them like the Japanese was for us for the rest of the movie. It was kind of just a, oh, hey, I understand leche, talking about milk for the baby,
you know? Right. Yep, yeah, I kind of felt the same way. That was a neat moment.
Yeah, I guess, because what happens is, I guess I can give, would, should we give more, a little more of the plot?
Well, I don't know that we need to. Basically, the they find the baby and they decide that they want to find the mother, you know? And because I really want to get into the rest of it.
Yeah, I know, me too.
So if we could just make this our point. And,
okay.
If you guys want to watch the movie without hearing about the rest of it, here's your spot.
Yeah, I think the thing to say is I embraced it immediately. Scott had more trouble with it.
Yeah, I had more trouble just at the beginning, and but once I kind of let myself get into the movie, I really enjoyed it. And like you said, there's a lot of meaning in this movie.
Well, it's kind of an abrupt beginning, I have to say. I was surprised because I'd forgotten it starts right off with Hana and Jin being the two homeless people who nobody wants in the audience, and it's very realistically drawn.
Mm-hmm.
There is, I guess the reason it's PG-13, there's language and stuff. And also there are a few scenes like there's somebody who feeds the baby and she's feeding the baby. She's breastfeeding and they don't shy away from showing that. You know, it's not a big deal, but I guess it could be for people. I don't know.
Yeah, it's not something that we're used to seeing animated.
No.
Yeah. But yeah.
But I think it's easy to get into because it's fairly Western looking. And when you're watching it, you can kind of have fun also looking at how the Japanese are celebrating Christmas and New Year. And some of the stuff, like when we were watching, Tom was like, what a good idea, because the traffic cones at night, they all are lit up from the inside so you could see them. So if a street's being worked on, they're lit up.
Yeah.
And so you see a lot of details like that too.
That's funny. I didn't notice that, but...
He immediately did. I thought, I thought it was a Christmas decoration. He goes down the middle of the street and went, I don't know. It's okay, fine, you're right.
It is a good idea.
And in Beethoven's Ninth, you'll hear little snatches of that with all the other Christmas song. And I'll just say here before we go to the spoilers that, because this is the thing Tom's always like, be sure you tell them this. Beethoven's Ninth Symphony is hugely important to the Japanese at Christmas. One person I saw said, it is like their Jingle Bells, Silent Night, and every other Christmas song rolled into one. And it's so important that when Sony was working with Philips on developing the CD, the format and the length and everything, I think Philips wanted to make it an hour. And Sony said, no, it has to be 90 minutes because we have to be able to fit Beethoven's Ninth Symphony on there. How are we going to sell Christmas music? And they did. That's why it's 90 minutes long.
How about that?
Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. And so you'll hear other Christmas music, but you'll hear that, little snatches of that, like on speakers and things. And at the end of the movie with the crazy dancing buildings, there's like an electronic pop version of it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, you know, updating Jingle Bells.
Right, right.
Kind of thing. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Enjoy. When you told me that, I listened to the Ninth Symphony again and I love it.
Oh,
how
cool
is that? Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder how that got connected.
Well, and it's that perfect way of how they take something and adapt it for their own use and thoroughly enjoy it, because at least, you know, we sing it, the Ode to Joy, and hear it a lot at Easter. And I don't know if that's when Beethoven wrote it for, I imagine. But they use it for Christmas. And it works either way.
Yeah, sure does.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So I just wanted to say that. Now great. Tom will be happy I told everyone. It's interesting trivia.
Yeah, it is. Well, great. Okay.
Spoilers.
So, spoilers, yes. So now I was shocked by Miyuki.
Well, you know,
each of these people had their own story about why they were homeless.
Yeah.
And I found it really interesting. First of all, Jin lied to even his, you know, family there, you know, this right. made up family that he's got now, and how he lied initially about why he was there.
Yeah.
He couldn't even to them. I mean, the whole reason he was there was basically shame. And he couldn't even reveal that to these two who, you know, if you couldn't to anyone, why not these two? And that was an interesting statement about, you know, once it's finally is revealed, how that changes his character. And it is palpable in there.
And even to Miss Hannah, who, you know, come on, she's going to be naturally more of an outcast as a transvestite.
Yeah. Yeah, that too. And when I originally started this thought, I was thinking about Miyuki.
Oh,
now, Miyuki stabbed her father.
Yep.
And
over,
you know,
her cat.
Over her cat, yeah. And that really shocked me.
I agreed. Because, her cat was missing, and her father had never liked the cat, I guess. And he was yelling at her. All you see is at one point you finally see her remembering that she stabbed him.
Yeah.
And
she was very remorseful about it. But, you know, and obviously a lot of things happened leading up to that. You know, it wasn't implied that she just snapped and stabbed her dad. I mean, there was obviously a lot of trouble all the way up to that spot.
Well, and it was a very, even though we didn't understand what led her to that point, it was a scene like you might see in any movie. Her father's standing there clutching his side going, how could you do that? And she's standing there going, I can't believe what I did, but how could you've never paid attention to me and this and that. And in the corner, her mother's standing there with her hands up, praying praying in the corner with her eyes shut. Like, I can't believe this is happening. I don't know what to do. And I thought it was interesting. She was a lot fatter.
Yeah, that was
interesting. She'd lost weight on the street, so she was normal.
Isn't that an interesting detail to throw in there? Yeah. And, I mean, little details like that makes me want to watch it again.
Well, yeah, and I would say because those things all highlight everybody did something that they were horribly ashamed of.
Mm-hmm.
And funnily enough, Miss Hannah's is probably the least of the offenses, but Jin basically was, let's see, he had a gambling problem.
Yeah, he told them initially that he was this big bike racer, and
right.
he ended up throwing a race and was very ashamed about it, which was a complete lie. He actually owned a bike shop and gambled away their money and left out of shame.
Yeah, and then he just abandoned his family. So right. his wife and daughter, as we find out when he meets his daughter, Kyoko,
mm-hmm.
later,
mm-hmm.
that they were trying to run the shop and going to look for him everywhere.
Right.
So you've got that. And then Miyuki, of course, did that horrible thing, stabbed her father that she was ashamed of. And Miss Hana had attacked somebody in the bar or the club that she worked for.
Yeah.
And she and her boyfriend slash husband Ken left, and then when Ken died, she went to the streets because the only home she knew was with that club. Mm-hmm. All the people at the club. That was one of those funny moments where the owner says, "Well, so what happened? Where's Ken?" She, "Oh, he died." And she's like, "Oh, AIDS?
Mm-hmm.
He slipped on a bar of soap." Oh, you know, very prosaic and almost comical.
Yeah.
But all of them have that same problem of everybody in their lives forgave them fairly readily.
Yes.
They couldn't mm-hmm. forgive themselves. They cut themselves off mm-hmm. and left everyone who loved them because of their own sense of guilt. Because Jin's family was looking for him. His daughter, when he comes across her miraculously again,
mm-hmm.
Is perfectly willing to, you know, talk to him. She's just glad to know he's okay. She would like to have him visit her. She's going to get married. She wants him to be at the wedding. You know, Miyuki, the teenage girl, she sees her father. Like, how many times she comes across her father's path is almost comical because she's constantly, because of this baby, being put in the path of her father, whether it's on the two trains that are stopped next to each other. And he's like yelling, going, "Hey, hey," you don't know why then. But later she finds an ad when she's looking for something else, an ad in the paper saying, "Angel came home, mm-hmm. you know, please come home."
Right, right.
To her. Hers is the last reconciliation. Her father happens to be the policeman who brings in the couple whose baby Kyoko is.
Mm-hmm.
So, and really the baby is the instigating, I hate to say device, but character that's used to take them out of their cardboard box and get them out in the path of where things can be made to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the baby is a means of grace, whether I made that name up or whether it's said in the voiceover part or the dubbing.
Mm-hmm.
But the baby is a means of grace. She is God's messenger. And that's made really clear by a couple of miraculous things that happen at the end.
Mm-hmm.
When Miss Hannah's falls off the building with the baby.
Yeah.
And then at the end, after Miyuki and her father meet and the baby winks at the camera, you know, it's like, okay, we got it. But the other thing is the baby actually, what you find out, since we're in huge spoiler territory, the baby actually, when they return her to the person who left her in the trash, had been stolen from the hospital by a woman whose heart had been broken because her own baby died before it was born, and her husband was he was a very unsatisfactory character. He was, I guess, a gambler and a dreamer or something,
mm-hmm.
to where basically they were driven apart by all of that, and he never paid attention to her. Obviously he's living in a home, but he might as well be homeless because he's just surrounded by bags of trash and newspapers and stuff, and he's fairly young. So that brings him to a realization of what's going on when he sees her on the TV getting ready to jump off the building with the baby.
Mm-hmm.
So
right,
the baby is a means of grace for everybody she encounters. for God to touch them.
Yeah, yeah,
exactly. I mean, that's really clear. Even the people, even the reviews I read of people who called the opening sermon by the, well, you know, it was Christmas Eve.
Yeah, yeah.
He says, this one review I read says, "We are shown a semi-fanatical religious ceremony in which two of the main characters are attending to in order to obtain a free meal." And I'm like, what? I think it was just supposed to be church. Okay.
Yeah. So semi-fanatical.
Obviously, he's not a Christian, but he says, "I was surprised by this religious bump and initially wrote it off into the setting, but there's potentially a great deal of religious hinting and symbolism to be excavated from many pieces of Tokyo Godfathers." And then he's the one who says they're not distracting or overbearing, mm-hmm. because he loves the movie. He had picked it as highlighting for a Secret Santa movie thing that blogs were doing. Mm-hmm. And I'll send you a link to that so you can put it up there.
Okay, great.
But everybody who commented, there were about 8 or 10 people who commented, and all of them loved it. But only one person said, "As a Christian, I found it really inspirational." Everybody else just loved the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody could ignore the message about the coincidences and God guiding them.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, because think about it. When they're walking along through the snow and the guy who was pushing his car,
mm-hmm.
because it stalled on the street and he's been trapped under it because the car slid on top of him.
Yeah,
he's exactly the person they need to find in order to keep going with their quest.
Right, right. Yeah. And they save his life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they say, "Oh, we're going to go here." And he goes, "Oh, just so happens my daughter is marrying the son of, or you know, like one of the owners."
And my daughter's name is Kyoko.
Yeah, and my daughter's name is Kyoko. That's right.
Yeah.
Forgot that.
Yeah, that's when, you know, it started to pique my, you know, interest. Well, I mean, I was interested in the whole thing, but mm-hmm. when it started to kind of gather what was happening, it was right then. That was the moment. And when he said his daughter was named Kyoko, I said, "Oh, really?" You know, so mm-hmm. now it just all kind of started to fall together, and, you know, enjoyed the rest of it. Enjoyed the, you know, all the stuff that was just like you were saying, these coincidences and these miraculous happenings that just happened once these people got out of where they were. Like you said, you know, they're out in the world. Now things can happen to them. But it was clear that it was God doing all of the acting.
Well, yeah. And something I found interesting, too, is a lot of movies like this would just ignore how's the baby eating, who's changing the diapers,
mm-hmm.
where are they getting all this stuff. They don't. And it's part – sometimes it's their quest to find food for the baby or diapers or whatever along the way that kind of leads them into the path of, you know, where they're being nudged
right,
to get
right.
back into their proper place in the world with the people who love them. And so that they can be, as the guy said, as they can come alive
mm-hmm.
and yep. be who they're supposed to be.
Yeah. It's your turn to change the diaper. And
right.
Miyuki goes to the bathroom to do so. And, you know, at this wedding.
Right.
Yeah. So, right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Because
when she comes out is when she gets taken hostage because there's a gang-style killing that happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Right.
And Jin, when he's there, he's like, "Oh, my gosh, the guy who's going to marry, you know, the bridegroom is the guy who lured me into the gambling scheme."
Right.
That lost me everything. So, and that's when Miss Hana goes, "What?" You know, I mean, as different parts of his life are being revealed through things like this, he's having to tell the real story.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And again, confession comes up again because once he finally can tell them exactly what happened, you know, that's when things start to get better for him.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And even things that don't seem like they make sense, where you say, why is this even in here? The thing where the rich young guys on New Year's Eve are beating up and killing the old homeless guy that he's found.
Mm-hmm.
And then they beat Jin up too, and you're just looking at this going, I could easily imagine this being one of the problems with New Year's Eve celebrations in Japan. And you see their callousness. They're beating the people up, and one of them's answering the phone going, "Hey, the girls are at this club. Should we go now?" You know?
Yeah, that was an interesting moment, too.
Yeah, they don't relate to their humanity at all. Mm-hmm. They kill one person. Well, I guess he's really actually was dead already. But they almost kill Jin. And as Jin crawls away, he winds up being rescued by Miss Hana's club members, or, you know, the people who work at the club Miss Hana used to work at, and that forces her back into reconciliation.
That was a funny moment, too. Because you think this is an angel, you know, an angel of God here to save him, and right. It's not.
Do you want me, or do you want the ambulance? he says, the ambulance, and the angel goes, oh, the hell with that, or something. You're like, what? Turns out she was one of the girls dressed up as an angel for the club.
Yeah, that was something else that made me laugh.
It's funny because, yeah, and another angel.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, there's always the angels and Kyoko. It's like this little string of things nudging them everywhere they go.
Mm-hmm. And right. You know, a lot of times in movies, you know, when coincidence has happened, you just like, you know, that's sloppy writing. But I, you know, that's like, it's the point of the whole thing.
This is deliberate.
Yeah, this is deliberate. And it works very, very well in the story.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's Rose pointed out, and I hadn't really thought of it this way. She said to her, the movie was about really the Holy Family. And of course, I think that's a super Catholic thing. I don't think Protestants really think about the Holy Family as much as Catholics do. And maybe that's because we look at, you know, Mary and Joseph are saints.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to emulate them. We ask them for help in our situation and families. But she said, you know, first thing you see is the baby. The next thing you see is the Holy Family.
Mm-hmm.
Then you see, you know, the kids and whatever in the movie. And she goes, then they all these people reflect families somehow. And Kyoko leads everybody back to the families they were running away from.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of interesting. I just didn't even think about it.
Was she kind of likening these three homeless folks as a holy family?
Well, they made their own family.
Yeah, they did. Uh-huh.
And she didn't really say that they were a holy family, but they were doing the best they could for each other under those circumstances.
Yeah, I recall Hana saying something like, well, I'm not going to get pregnant, you know.
Right.
This is, you know, but the Virgin Mary did. You know, she actually mentioned
miraculous
the Virgin Mary.
Pregnancy.
And when you think about it, she was holding a baby. So now you've got some kind of a miraculous thing that happened.
A miraculous birth. Well, yeah, that's true. And I hadn't really thought of that aspect of it. And we didn't talk about it that much. Rose and I didn't. But that's a good point.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I'm just wondering, you know, if it goes farther than that. But, you know, Jin as some kind of a Joseph figure, because at the beginning he's a failure of a Joseph figure.
Mm-hmm.
He's like the opposite because, you know, Joseph obviously stepped up and did what was needed of him, and this guy ran away.
And there aren't any other mothers in the movie, really. You don't ever see Jin's wife because she's left and married somebody else, we assume, or that's his guess.
Mm-hmm.
Miyuki, the only time you see her mother, she tells... Oh, that's the other mother you see, the Latina.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. What about her?
Yeah, she's, and I think they might have been actually, Tom looked this up and I didn't. He said there's a Filipino community that lives in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Community meaning just people. They're like workers.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't, which would make sense, I guess, Japan, the Philippines. So they're like a lower class group. Which would be why the guy could pretend to be a waiter He was pretending to be a waitress. But when he was trying to shoot somebody and then when he takes Miyuki back, there is a mother. And she's a very nurturing mother. She already has her own baby, but she takes care of the other baby. She's interested in Miyuki and her family.
Yeah, and I think that was a big moment for Miyuki. That whole time that she spent in the room with that mother. That was a big time for her. Very important for her.
Yeah. It was that nurturing. She needed somebody to nurture her beyond what her two friends could give her.
Mm-hmm.
And a time for reflection that, you know, she wasn't allowed to refuse it. And she was showing pictures. Mm-hmm. So she had pictures.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I think that's when she started to head down the right spot.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, the baby is what... got her there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So, yeah.
Because then when she's been there, Miss Hannah finds her and they're off on their adventure again.
Mm-hmm.
I also like the fact that, and this is just, I think this is just a plot-driven thing, but it was kind of funny that a lot of times what you see people claiming, even though it wasn't true, is what wound up happening by the end of the movie. Like, the two examples I can really think of are Jin, who Miss Hannah would say something, and Jin would go, we are not action figures in a movie. We cannot go off and just do this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was lying and saying he was a big bicycle racer. And then the huge chase scene at the end of the movie, which is like a big action movie, he is hanging onto the edge of the truck. Uh-huh. He is trying to jump into it. So that's like the action figure.
That's right. And he is riding the bike.
You're better than an action figure, Jin, as they're chasing in the taxi. And then before that, he's chasing on the bicycle like a bicycle racer, you know, over the handlebars as fast as he can go. And so he's doing that too.
Yeah.
You know, all the lies he told are actually there down deep.
Mm-hmm.
He's denying that and lying about it, but it's funny that they then had those come around. All the strands got pulled up together.
Yeah, that's really something else.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, that was just funny to see. And it was handled usually for laughs.
Yeah, yeah, it was good. I mean, it was all handled really good. But yeah, when you think about it in all that context, it's just, you know, I'm kind of, as we talk about this, I'm kind of in awe of the folks who wrote this thing. Because that was really something else. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they set it all up and then they tie it all up.
Well, and I found it really touching, actually, that Miyuki, the names, I have trouble keeping them straight. But the teenage girl, yes, Miyuki, is the one who winds up on top of the building when Sachiko, who's the woman who kidnapped the baby, has grabbed the baby up again. They mistakenly returned the baby to her. So now she's going to kill herself so she can be with her baby and be reborn, as she says.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got the baby with her. She's got Kyoko with her. And Miyuki is saying, but we're only born once.
Yeah.
This baby's life is important. And she manages to talk her into giving her the baby, or she was getting ready to when everything happens.
Mm-hmm.
To startle the woman into not wanting to do it anymore, if I'm remembering that right now.
Yeah,
sure.
And that was a big moment. You know, that's I was really touched by what she said there about this baby. Yeah, is only born
has
once.
One life.
Yeah, it only has one life, and this is its, you know, this baby's chance.
Mm-hmm.
And you shouldn't take that away from her.
Right.
You know, so I mean, that was an interesting argument. That made me wonder, you know, what the Japanese feeling about abortion is, you know, that general, I know they all don't think and feel the same way, but I mean, what's the prevailing opinion of it?
Yes. And I mentioned that in an email, and so I went and looked around because I couldn't really, I didn't know, I had no idea. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, when you mentioned abortion, and so I was kind of talking about it at home, and then someone said, well, this kind of brings us back to the idea of this woman is so remorseful. She misses her baby. And of course, she was hoping the baby would fix a lot of things in her life. And of course, that's a huge mistake to ever think that.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
we'll just say that now. And we all know that wouldn't have been right. But, it kind of brings you back to the idea of when you don't want it, it's a fetus.
Mm-hmm.
When you want the baby, it's a baby.
Right.
Whether they're born or not. And
I think it's important to note that, you know, for the entire movie up to the near the end, I thought the baby was abandoned. And that was part of the story. We all thought that the baby was abandoned. So it was an unwanted child That was what, you know, you assume as you move on. And then it's only later that you found out that this baby had been stolen, you know, so the mother did want the baby.
Right. It's everything is in the context of an abandoned child. And the whole reason they're going to find it is because Miss Hannah says, no, I want to look these parents in the face and ask them why they threw love away into the trash. because love is precious and you should never throw it away.
Right.
Or some words to that effect, very strongly stated. And so you're like, oh, so you have this baby is important. Never throw love away like this. It doesn't matter how it comes to you, I think she even says. Mm-hmm. Never get rid of it. I mean, it's an insanely Christian message all the way through, especially when what I did find on abortion is most of what I found didn't deal with what the Japanese people might think. It was with, here are the laws, here's how long it's been followed, here are the numbers. And I did find an article, I will send you the link so you can put it to it, and it's called Julia McCarthy on Attitudes Toward Abortion in Japan. It was written in 2006, and I think she had lived there for a while. The picture was of a younger woman, and you know, the place I got it, I think it was maybe a think tank type place.
Mm-hmm.
We can look and kind of qualify that more, mm-hmm. because the last couple of paragraphs get into her personal opinion about Japan's so great and we're so awful, mm-hmm. and how we deal with this and think about it. And to me, that's not germane to the point of what she's talking about.
Yeah. But
what she says is that there attitude is really, really different because until the introduction of oral contraceptives, they used abortion as their primary means of birth control.
Hmm.
Now, I think that could be said of America too, but it sounds like there was much less stigma. It says there's no stigma against the parents, despite Japanese Buddhists believing that life begins at the moment of conception. In the case of abortions, the Japanese generally do not blame the same party as Westerners. In Japanese Buddhist belief, it is the children, not the parents, to whom the blame falls. For causing their parents great suffering, the souls of the prematurely deceased are sent to the underworld, a sort of limbo river. To regain Buddhist favor, these water children erect small stone pillars while fending off underwater demons. And we read that to my family. We all just went, that is so Japanese. I don't get it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
that's interesting because Buddhists believe in reincarnation, right?
I think so.
And isn't Shinto really kind of a... Buddhist
Shinto
religion?
Is different. Buddhism is wound into it, and Shinto is super hard to explain, and I only know the tiniest bit in that it combines like nature worship and mm-hmm. ancestor worship and some of Buddhism. Uh-huh. And we had two different Japanese interns live with us at two different times. Our grade school for a while held this program where they would help teach the third grade and introduce them to all this Japanese stuff. And so we were the host family. For one girl for a year and for another girl for half a year.
Mm-hmm.
And when I would ask them about Shinto, they were the most secular people you could possibly imagine. They're like, oh, well, it's the way we live, but we don't have to believe it. And we were like, what? You know, and every time I've come across this, an actual person to ask, they're always kind of like, oh, some people believe it more than others, but blah, 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 blah. And so I think it's super Japanese. They have a hard time explaining it.
Hmm.
And it may have rebirth in it. I think Buddhism does, right?
I'm fairly sure that Buddhism does. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just here on Wikipedia, I've looked up a Shinto, and then there's a section called Afterlife. It says, it's common for families to participate in ceremonies for children at a shrine, yet have a Buddhist funeral at the time of death. The Japanese conception of the afterlife, however, can sometimes take a distinctly non-Buddhist turn. In old Japanese legends, it is often claimed that the dead go to a place called Yomi, a gloomy underground realm with a river separating the living from the dead. This Yomi is very close to the Greek Hades. Hmm.
Hmm.
Yeah, so again, that's Wikipedia, so I don't know.
Well, I tend to... By the way, Wikipedia is having a fund drive, and for as much as I use it, I actually gave them some money, some $10, because they've gotten much better about being reliable, I think.
Yeah, and I do think so, too. The whole crowdsourcing thing, I think, does have this corrective effect on it.
Yeah, I'll just mention. So if you use it at all, like I do, give them $5.
Yeah, for sure.
That's cheap. What I was going to say, though, is she talks about a shrine at Hasadera, or maybe that's the name of the... it's a temple in Kamakura, Japan. And sorry, anybody listening who knows, I'm murdering any pronunciations, I'm sure. But this is a place, it says, where what they do is it's a stone, and she wrote J-I-Z. I don't know how you say that, so I was saying jizz.
Mm-hmm.
These little figures represent the souls of those whose chance to live was stripped from them in the womb. Though jizz acts as the guardian to children, expectant mothers, firemen, and travelers, Mizuko jizz in particular protect the souls of the unborn. Thousands of these statues line the stairs, the walls, the entire perimeter of this stunning temple, each signifying an aborted or miscarried baby.
Hmm.
And she was saying later in the article that the parents do these to protect their souls, easing their suffering and sentences, and it's supposed to guide them on the right path to the, okay, here it is. I just didn't remember it. Six realms of reincarnation. And it says that the parents then will honor the memory of their children by dressing them in baby things. Hmm. Mickey Mouse bibs, hand-knit baby hats, sweaters of baby blue and light pink, toy trains, teddy bears are with them. And it says that then, of course, they're left there to age as a memorial. And this person was like, and it's a beautiful memorial. And I thought, you know what? As somebody who miscarried two children, I see that part could be a memorial. But as a memorial to an aborted baby, it made me want to cry. It makes me want to cry thinking about it now. It's a tragic loss of a person, each one of those. Now, obviously, the Japanese people aren't going to think about it the same way. So that's a huge cultural divide. But this movie doesn't reflect a single thing of that way of thinking.
Hmm.
I would say.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think so either. Yeah.
It's pro-life, without that negative pro-life connotation that Americans tend to have of being kind of pounding.
Yeah, yeah.
But the point's made always.
Yeah,
from the
moment the baby's found, the baby is very special. And, you know, everybody in the whole movie, you know, treats that baby as such.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so your point about abortion,
they're horrified that somebody would have dropped it off there.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. And the stupid thing was, obviously, the person wasn't thinking right anyway, because it was in a bag of trash. I mean, not tied at the top, but with a note saying, please take care of me. But it was in the middle of all these bags of trash.
Mm-hmm.
If they hadn't been jostling things around, they never would have heard it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which
is another miracle.
I don't think they're setting out to say anything necessarily about abortion per se, but what they are saying is that all life matters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
which ultimately goes back to that.
Right. Right. Yeah. Which is the reason that Catholics and Christians and everything care, because the place in this article where this person is kind of railing against American tradition, she's like, she doesn't get it right. She's saying, though these parents may have denied a life, their peers do not deny them the right to grieve. And I would say that unless you're wrongheaded about it, neither do Christians or Catholics, or which we are Christians, so I guess I can quit making that distinction. But we don't, you know, if you make a horrible mistake, you make a horrible mistake and you move on. You can't rail against those people.
Mm-hmm.
But she was saying that the protests at the abortion clinics are denying them that right to grieve. And I'm like, no, that's trying to save a life before it's stripped away.
Mm-hmm.
There are places like Rachel's Vineyard and places like that to help people kind of heal and get over that whole having done that.
Yeah.
And the guilt or shame of that, whatever they may feel or whatever somebody else has inflicted on them. Because I think there have been a number of valid studies showing that people who have abortions feel it always.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I don't think I've told you that too either, but you know, we lost a baby as well. Miscarriage.
I don't remember you saying that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well.
It's a horrible.
But yeah, I mean, just knowing how that feels, I just can't imagine.
Exactly. You know, and and I have to say, considering I lived most of my life completely okay with everything that the world would say about, you know, it's just a mass of cells before it's born, blah, blah, blah. I would say, by the grace of God, I'm so glad I was spared that. because mm-hmm. that's easily a decision I would have made in perfectly good conscience.
Yeah.
When I was, you know, before I became mm-hmm. a Christian.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm glad I don't have that to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have other things, which is why we have confession and everything else.
Plenty of other stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but this was saying, though Americans claim to support the separation of church and state, religiously rooted views concerning abortion continue to play a divisive role in the American political forum. If one of America's primary allies can offer a civil and humane solution to an arguably inhumane practice, why can't America do the same? And see, this is where I think this person is so passionate about it that their logic is completely flawed.
Because yeah, that doesn't really make any sense.
To me, the American civil government put their hands on something that's a religious thing
mm-hmm.
that you're going to feel about based on your culture and your religion, as is obvious from the difference between the Japanese and the Americans.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And that's something that's going on right now. I mean, it's happened in the government for a long time, but
yeah.
This whole, you know, conscience protection, you know, and yeah. the argument against it.
Yeah.
I just don't understand the argument against it. You know, we're all Americans. We all need to live together.
Right.
You need to let me do what I need to do, you know, mm-hmm. and I need to let you do what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the line is where you're hurting other people. So,
right.
Yeah. And, right now the other side is got the upper hand and they're doing
aggressive.
Yeah. They're doing a number on us all right now.
No, that's for dang sure.
Yeah. So, hopefully that pendulum will swing back, but the problem is when the pendulum does swing back, you know, the aggression comes from the other side and
right.
we really need a middle where we're all like, you get to exist and I get to exist and let's exist. Let's be happy.
I think that's the thing is people have to give others the credit for they're acting in their own best way that they can
mm-hmm.
according to what they know and believe. And we have to give them the freedom for God to work with them, basically, whether they believe in him or not.
Mm-hmm.
As a Christian, you have to be able to say, I'm going to trust you're doing the best you can.
Mm-hmm.
Some people aren't, obviously, but some people aren't no matter what side you're on.
Yeah, yeah.
But I would say for the majority, that's true. And there's a book that I read and reviewed a long time ago called The Right to Be Wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And now I wish I could find it on my shelf, but I will give you a link to it and to wherever my review ran, if it's still up. And if it's not, I probably need to rerun it on Happy Catholic. But
mm-hmm.
basically, it was a group that will defend freedom no matter what it is you want to believe. And unlike, you know, some groups who will go, well, we don't think that's a freedom that we care about, they'll defend any of it because they're like, you have the right to be wrong. We are going to allow you the right to choose your own path. And for other people to keep their hands off of it. And so they'll take things from both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really, that was illuminating to me. And also when I read All the Pope's Men by John Allen, and I think I talked about that before, he thought he was even-handed and found out he wasn't. And then the way he talked about people from the conservative or liberal side of the church who are in the Vatican going, don't forget, we all want the same thing. We just see different ways to get there.
Yeah, yeah.
And those really helped kind of inform me on, I might not agree on this thing, but let's try to get there together.
Right, right.
In the middle.
There needs to be a whole lot more of that.
Yeah.
There's a book by Peggy Noonan called Patriotic Grace, which
I haven't read that.
It's a good little book. It's very, very small. Yeah. Came out before the last presidential election.
Okay.
Where she was just saying that, hey, we're getting to a point here where we are not going to be able to function and we need to come together and work on the bigger things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, you know, we tend to agree on the bigger stuff, you know, so
yeah,
it's all these little details we get mired in and, you can't do that and you can't do that. And that's all I'm going to worry about right now. You know, it's, you know, as the car's going off the cliff,
right.
You know, we're worried about what color the car is or something.
Yeah, so, what was it? I saw a link to an article yesterday that's kind of this kind of global madness that's taken over in this way of a German guy who filed suit to sue the Pope because he didn't wear a seatbelt when he was in Germany or something, according to a picture. And
oh my gosh,
that's a German law. And it's like, okay, really? Stop it. Okay.
Yeah.
You're just a nuisance.
It's tough. Yeah.
Well, we're far away from the movie.
Yeah. Well, no, it's all part of it.
But everything.
Yeah, I really, you know, I thank you for the movie.
Well, I'm glad.
Yeah. And again, you know, talking about it even puts it higher up in my esteem, and I want to watch it again. Because a lot of those little details and the symbolism I've missed. So I'm looking forward to watching that again and looking for all of that.
Yeah. Well, and there was one thing I wanted to just laugh about with you, which to me, it was like one of the most wonderful scenes in the movie that pointed out that Kyoko is being used as an instrument of God, is when they're in that convenience store and there's only four people in there. The owner, some drunk guy is buying cigarettes or something. And then Jin and Hana, well, I guess five people, and Kyoko, and the baby starts crying and the guy's complaining about how they smell. So like, okay, fine. So they go outside and the drunk guy follows them. A huge argument starts. So all four of them are outside on the sidewalk arguing like crazy. And right as they get outside and start doing that, an ambulance crashes into the convenience store.
Right.
Which is tiny. Yeah. And it would have killed or maimed all of them.
Uh-huh.
And the ambulance driver staggers out and goes, "Somebody call an ambulance." So it shows you the grace, the coincidence, the humor, everything, and the piece of Japanese life, because it's New Year's Eve. So, you know, it's a time for celebrating. Of course, the guy be drinking too much and, you know, need his cigarettes or whatever.
Heck yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a good moment.
Yeah. So to me, that was an encapsulating moment, I think.
Yeah. Alex was watching it with me, my 11-year-old daughter, and we looked at each other at that and laughed.
Yeah, that's, they have this broad humor, or like, you know, Hana, Miss Hana, who was so dramatic that whenever she'd suddenly go, "Oh, that's all right," and just start off on one of her speeches, and by the end of the movie, for sure, you know, I would think anybody would just be laughing because, oh, there she goes again.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I got done the first time watching it, even though I was kind of put off by Miss Hana at the beginning, I loved her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
You may not have felt that way.
No, I did. I did feel that way. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. I sure did.
The drama and everything. And you can see how that little family would have loved her.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So.
Yeah. People are people. It's good.
That's kind of it. And that's this. I just think this is a really unusual movie. And this guy's career, Satoshi Kon's career, was cut quite short because he died of cancer at 46.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's too bad.
And it was a big surprise because nobody knew about it. I mean, he'd been making public appearances fairly soon up to the point of his death.
Mm, wow.
But he obviously knew he was dying because he'd made complete notes about his final movie, and he'd been finishing a script and making all the notes so somebody else could make it. Huh. It hasn't been made yet.
How about that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, anyway, so.
Yep. But yeah, thanks again. That was a very atypical Christmas movie.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you're looking for something different, definitely check it out.
I'm glad you liked it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. Me too.
Yeah, I know. Like I say, I was really afraid. I was watching it and I was going, oh, is this going to be my contact? Where Scott's like, what did you do to me?
What did you make
and
me
my
watch?
Child.
Oh, I love it.
I was worried.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. Well, cool. All right. Well, thanks everyone for tuning in.
Yeah.
And enjoy your Advent season.
Yeah. So next up, we're going to be talking about Hogfather.
That's right. Yep.
By Terry Pratchett. So another atypical Christmas choice, I would say.
Oh, great.
It's No Christmas Carol. Have you read it?
Nope, I have not.
Oh,
nope, I've got
okay.
it and ready to roll.
I apologize for everything.
No, I'm excited because Pratchett novels are always one of those things that I meant to read. You know, I think my only... Well, I read Good Omens, but that was written by Neil Gaiman. And then there was a novella, a Pratchett novella. I don't recall what the name was, in a collection called Legends, which was Robert Silverberg edited it. You know, it's just novellas from these people's various universes. And the audio version I listened to. Terry Pratchett was in one of those sets.
Okay.
And I enjoyed it very much. I remember Turtles all the way down. Turtles all the way down.
Well, yeah, Turtles all the way down.
Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to think, because he has different sets of characters he'll write about. And this one pulls quite a few of them into the same story. This one has death is the main character, is a main character, mm-hmm. his adopted daughter. Those corporals from Ankh-Morpork, if that's how you say it.
Oh, cool.
And
a bunch. This will be fun.
Basically, yeah. But Hogfather is what they would basically call Father Christmas.
All right, Santa cool.
So that gives you the start for it.
Nice, nice. Yeah. Well, it's on my Kindle waiting to be read.
Okay, well, I have the actual candy striped version of it. So.
Nice.
All right.
Okay, well, take care, everybody. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Bye. Thank you.